Meet Rachel Morrison. I'm so honored to be here, and I really want all the women in the room to stand up, because I feel like I don't get here without you guys.
And there was the Oscar presenter and actor Javier Bardem, who called for no war from the stage and also talked about a free Palestine.
No to war and free Palestine.
And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Taracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Kyle Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Toreri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. Amy.
And I just want to say, for people to watch our Oscar interviews over these last months, you can go to democracynow.org. They're a fantastic array, especially around the documentary category, both the short and long category, as well as our interview with Ryan Coogler, the Oscar-winning director of Sinners.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, unionized Portland Community College faculty and staff are on strike.
The PDX Airport rebuffs a second Trump administration video blaming Democrats for travel woes.
And a new report says data centers threaten Columbia Gorge climate goals.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 16th, 2026. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Unionized staff and faculty at Portland Community College are on strike in the first community college strike in Oregon's history. The unions voted to authorize a strike last month after what they called an insulting final offer from the college. The college offered a 0.35% cost of living increase for both of the next 2 years. Cost of living adjustments, or COLAs, are often indexed to inflation, which is usually between 2 and 3%, which keeps workers' wages from degrading in value over time. There are other issues at stake, too, including retroactive pay and the cutting of popular programs. PCC says they need to balance their budget since they're facing rising costs, declining enrollment, and little state or federal funding help. KBOO reporter Masato was on the picket line earlier today. Here's what he heard from the striking workers.
Hello, my name is David. I'm a mental health counselor at PCC. I work with our students who are seeking their high school credential with the Yes to College program.
Okay. Why are you on strike today?
Well, I'd also like to say that I'm the organizing officer for the FFAP, which is the federation that represents academic professionals, full-time and part-time faculty. We're on strike today for fair pay, for our fair share of the budget that the state has sent the college, and to make real positive change at the college. While we're on strike for those things that I mentioned, we're also fighting for course scheduling that makes sense, and that to keep a robust community college here in the city for Portland, because our administrators seem hell-bent on managing the decline of this institution where there's no need for that. We are robust, we can grow, and we can continue to offer the Portland community the education they deserve.
Okay.
I'm a student at PCC. What was the question?
Why are you on strike today?
Why am I on strike? Because everyone should be able to afford to live, and it's not fair that they're offering like pennies compared to what the people at the top are making. And I think it's great that they're saying no.
My name is Lara Messersmith-Glavin, and I teach developmental reading and writing as well as creative writing and literature at Southeast Campus.
Okay, and why are you on strike?
We're on strike for a number of reasons. There's been a lot of tension, I think, between faculty and administration for a long time. We haven't seen the kinds of support that we need to care for our students the way that we would like. It's easy to reduce it to numbers. Things like the COLA is a great flashpoint and an easy talking point, but I think it really also has to do with the way that we're seeing funds being distributed to cover administration and not to cover classes that students need, not to fund the programs that students want and love, like music and sonic arts, for instance. And also, we want to make sure that our part-time faculty and all of our classified staff are well taken care of, and right now it doesn't feel like they are.
Mm. What has the treatment been like from the college itself?
Regarding the strike itself?
Yes.
I was actually surprised how antagonistic and unwilling to like engage in civil discourse the administration has been, you know, with common kind of strike-breaking techniques like sending out disingenuous or sometimes even false information to students and to the community, not approaching the bargaining process with good faith. It has felt like remarkably antagonistic, in fact, and has kind of made me feel like maybe we're not all on the same page for the students in the community like I thought we were.
Mm. Yeah. What do you want folks at home to know and understand about the strike?
I think more than anything, we want folks to know that this is not about, like, just give us more money. This is about the learning conditions for our students are the working conditions for faculty and staff, and we want to feel like we're in a place that actually cares for our well-being as well as that of the students. We love our students more than anything, and that is also not a reason to take advantage of our labor.
That was KABU reporter Masato speaking with unionized faculty and staff at Portland Community College who are on strike. PCC says they will still try to offer classes and student services if possible. Grades for the current school term will be up within 5 days of staff returning, and if the strike lasts past the beginning of spring term, at the end of March, students could ask for a refund.
The Portland International Airport, or PDX, won't show a Trump administration video blaming Democrats for travel delays. It's the second time in 6 months that PDX has refused to show a political video to travelers at the airport. Officials say federal and state laws prevent public employees and resources from being used in political messaging, so they can't show it. The video included a message that attributed travel ban delays to, quote, the ongoing Democrat shutdown of TSA and the Department of Homeland Security, end quote. Democratic members of Congress say they would not approve more money for the department until lawmakers reined in the agency after ICE and Border Control agents shot and killed Alex Pretty and Renee Good in Minneapolis in January. Democrats want to tighten the requirements for immigration warrants, and they want agents unmasked, and for the Department of Homeland Security to introduce a code of conduct. The White House and Democratic lawmakers failed to reach a deal by the funding deadline, triggering a partial shutdown. That left many DSH employees working without pay, including TSA agents. They're designated as essential employees and are required to show up to work, even without pay. But there has been an increase in unscheduled absences or sick-outs. The Port of Portland refused to show a separate video of former Homeland Security Kristi Noem in October of 2025. In the video, she blamed travel delays on Democrats as part of a different government shutdown. For both videos, the port says the Hatch Act prevents the use of public assets for political messages. In addition, Oregon state law prohibits public employees from promoting or criticizing a political party while on duty. The port has placed donation bins in the pre-security area of the main terminal at PDX for people to drop off non-perishable food, household essentials, and grocery and gas gift cards for $25 or less for TSA agents.
Public records show the Portland Trailblazers lobbied hard to get lawmakers to fund renovations to the Moda Center, per reporting from Oregon Public Broadcasting. The team is now owned by subprime auto loan tycoon Tom Dundon. Last month, state lawmakers approved SB 1501, a bill designed to modernize the arena with the hope of keeping the Blazers as the anchor tenant. The bill would convert $365 million into state bonds earmarked towards the renovation of the Moda Center, with the remaining balance covered by the City of Portland and Multnomah County. Senate President Rob Wagner, author of the bill, said, quote, "Renovating Oregon's arena is the best investment we can make in Oregon's economic future," end quote. In 1993, then-owner Paul Allen funded the current basketball facility known as the Rose Garden Arena. Lobbyists with the Blazers say that kind of sweet deal is not possible with the new ownership group. Dundon has not said he'd relocate the Blazers without public funding committal, but Blazer lobbyists have intimated the importance of that funding. They say state and local governments should, quote, "be matching the confidence that the incoming Blazer ownership group has in Portland and Oregon when they made a $4.2 billion investment in the state," end quote. The lobbyists suggested Dundon could be easily swayed to move the team to another city. In a document sent to the mayor's office, the Trailblazer management team stated, quote, "In smaller markets like Portland, where venues cannot generate the same amount of revenue as teams in big markets like New York, San Francisco, and L.A., public investment is necessary to secure the long-term funding of a team," end quote. Blazer representatives said that the letter they are confident the Moda Center will need $600 million in renovations, but the number could increase based on inflation. If lawmakers move forward, renovations would start in 2027 to ensure the arena is finished before the NCAA Women's Final Four in 2030. The City of Portland officially purchased the Moda Center and the surrounding land from the estate of Paul Allen in August of 2024 for roughly $7 million. Portland City Councilor Mitch Green weighed in on his Instagram saying, quote, "We have a long ways to go before any funding decisions will be made. My bar is high on this, and I'm not an easy mark on a shiny pitch deck, thin on substance," end quote.
A new report highlights data center impacts along the Columbia River and how they could interfere with the region meeting its climate emission goals. As Isabel Charlet reports, it calls for more transparency and regulation and for data centers to not rely on fossil fuels for energy.
The rapid expansion of data centers in Washington and Oregon is threatening the region's shift to renewable energy, according to a new report. The report released by Columbia Riverkeeper identifies over 100 data centers that are completed or in progress across 12 counties bordering the Columbia River. Kelly Campbell, policy director for the organization, says power demand is expected to soar as a result of the data centers, and tech companies are turning to fossil fuels to provide that power.
We're looking at having to put together 4 new Seattle's worth of energy in order to power all these data centers. And my question would be why we shouldn't be going back to using more fossil fuels to power data centers.
The report calls on leaders in Oregon and Washington to impose more regulations on the centers, including transparency around water and energy use and a ban on fossil fuels and new nuclear. The report also calls for tech companies to be responsible for developing new renewable energy to supply the centers, helping the region stay on track to meet its climate goals. Campbell says part of the problem is there's still a lot the public doesn't know about data centers because operators keep details hidden. She adds the Oregonian newspaper had to sue the Dalles and Google to find out how much water Google was using in theirs. The company claimed it was a trade secret.
Our researchers had a hard time even finding basic facts like how many data centers there are, where are they located, how much energy do they use, how much water do they use.
A failed bill in Washington state this year would have regulated data centers and imposed transparency measures, but Campbell says operators like Microsoft and Amazon fought hard against it. She says Columbia Riverkeeper has called for a moratorium on construction of any new centers. At least, she says, data centers should pay their fair share. Last year's Power Act, passed in Oregon, directs regulators to make large energy users responsible for their own energy costs instead of being subsidized by residents. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth blames the media for misrepresenting the Iran war. A federal judge has blocked Justice Department subpoenas for Fed Chair Jerome Powell, and lawmakers introduce federal legislation to mandate tariff refunds. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Or more fake news from CNN. Reports that the Trump administration underestimated the Iran war's impact on the Strait of Hormuz. Patently ridiculous, of course.
With the Iran war in its third week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth blames the media for sullying the Trump administration's strategy. He says Iran has used the Strait of Hormuz, an important oil shipping route, as leverage for decades. But insider reports say administration hawks never consulted the Treasury Department or others about the economic impact of a conflict in the Gulf. With Iran attacking oil tankers and commercial vessels, the strait is essentially blocked, and oil is around $100 a barrel. The White House wants insurance companies to increase underwriting on the cargo, and says the U.S. is assembling a coalition led by the American Navy to escort the ships. Elise Labbitt with the American School of International Service says it should have been obvious it would be difficult, if not impossible, to stop Iran from blocking the crucial waterway off its coast.
Even if they're not actually shooting them down, they're creating the fear in the mind of the commercial shipping industry and in the mind of the oil industry that they don't want to use the strait right now.
Saying it'll reduce energy prices, President Donald Trump signed an executive order using a Cold War-era law to mandate a return to drilling off the California coast, and Energy Secretary Chris Wright is pushing to restart work on the state's Santa Ynez pipeline. But Governor Gavin Newsom says the pipeline's owners already face criminal charges and are legally prohibited from further work. Meanwhile, D.C. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro is criticizing a judge for denying Justice Department subpoenas of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. Justice James Boasberg ruled the case is animated by Trump's resentment of Powell and the president's demands for lower interest rates. Boasberg says the subpoenas are entirely unsupported by evidence. Pirro argues they're a legitimate legal tool, adding the American people deserve answers about the cost overruns Powell is accused of.
The American public is fed up with public monies that seem to go into a black hole, especially in D.C., where no one is held accountable.
Powell is likely to remain as Fed chair until his term expires in May. A bipartisan group of lawmakers have vowed to block Fed chair nominee Kevin Warsh's confirmation until the investigation ends. New federal legislation would give people nationwide tariff refunds. The Tariff Relief for Consumers Act uses the estimated $166 billion collected from Trump's first round of tariffs to reimburse consumers. Representative Rosa DeLauro, the bill's sponsor, says the goal is to give relief from everyday high prices.
The bill prohibits companies receiving refunds from paying out dividends or conducting stock buybacks until they have provided relief to consumers, because my view is that consumers and small businesses need to come before the wealthy shareholders.
According to the Yale Budget Lab, new levies Trump wants to impose would initially cost each consumer $572, but would rise to more than $1,100 if they're continuously renewed. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at the fight to keep Portland's Leech Botanical Garden alive amid serious funding shortages. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 59. Today in history, in 2021, 8 people were killed in the Atlanta spa shooting spree, including 8 Asian women. The perpetrator pled guilty to 8 counts of murder and is in prison for a life sentence. The quote of the day is from author and Asian American movement activist Grace Lee Boggs, who said, quote, "You don't choose the times you live in, but you do choose who you want to be and how you want to think."
A new exhibit in Arizona celebrates the life of a grocer known for serving the Navajo Nation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Chandler Museum in Arizona has a new exhibit called Being Eddie Basha. It's a retrospective of the hometown-turned-statewide grocer who died in 2013. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
Chandler Museum's storytelling coordinator, Sarah Biggerstaff, literally leaned on Basha's own words for one interactive display.
This is our telephone. There's about 20 clips, and they range from like 20 seconds to a minute. You can pick it up, give it a couple seconds, but then you hear him actually speaking. And at our opening, it was really moving.
I would want my epitaph to say, Eddie Basha. He was a good man, but a bad boy, and that's how I want to be remembered.
Another one of his principles was putting people over profits. The great-grandson of Lebanese immigrants brought his family brand to tribal lands, beginning in 1981 with the Dines supermarket in Chinle. Basha even committed 25 cents of every dollar to the Navajo Nation.
And of course, the relationship with the Navajo became extremely powerful and fruitful and still exists today.
From Tuba City to Window Rock, stores kept popping up. More locations would follow on Apache land in Parada and White River. The one-time gubernatorial candidate was also an avid collector of Western and American Indian art. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Athletes, coaches, and spectators crowded Main Street in downtown Whitehorse Saturday for the closing ceremonies of the Arctic Winter Games, also known as the Olympics of the North. And Team Alaska had a lot to celebrate. Among the 6 Arctic nations, it led the Ulu Count medal shaped like curved knives, emblematic of Arctic life. Alaska had 227 Ulus, followed by Team Yukon with 174, and Alberta North with 127. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, Parker Kenick of Nome took home 3 gold ulus and many lessons about life.
Parker Kenick started learning traditional Alaska Native games when he was 8, but didn't take part in the Arctic Winter Games until later in life. This year, he competed in the adult category and won gold ulus in the 2-foot high kick, the Alaskan high kick, and the one-hand reach. Kenick says he's grateful for community support that made it possible for him to travel to the games.
Our spirits get lifted here because there's so many people that want to see us do our best to our absolute limit.
Kenick competed in his first Arctic Winter Games in 2023 and says he was lucky to be mentored by some of the best Indigenous athletes in the world. But now he's returning the favor. One of his coaches, Candace Parker, says when Kenick first started out, he was quiet and kept to himself. But today, he readily volunteers to coach the younger athletes.
I would say full circle moment for him to be out on the floor passing on the knowledge and encouraging the athletes. May not have been technical, but doing more encouraging.
Parker says young people can be self-absorbed, but the games teach them to think beyond themselves. She says it's an important exercise in humility, one that athletes like Kenick have embraced. Parker has been coaching since 1996 and says this year she reached an important milestone, having three generations of her family compete in this year's Arctic Winter Games. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Opioid overdose rates in Washington have dropped slightly overall, but continue to rise in Native American communities, where they are nearly double those of other groups. Experts say access to naloxone, which is available over the counter, is an important step in addressing the problem. Isabel Charlet has the story.
While overall rates of opioid overdose in the state have decreased in recent years, data from the Washington Department of Health shows rates in American Indian and Alaska Native communities continue to increase and are almost double that of other populations. The state has been taking a number of measures to address the problem, including supplying thousands of doses of naloxone to community organizations, local governments, and tribes since 2019. Jen Olson with the American Indian Health Commission says while the data still paints a grim picture, having naloxone available has helped Native communities normalize talking about addiction.
There are things we can do along the way of addiction and helping somebody when they're not quite ready to go to treatment. We can at least make sure that we have naloxone out there and the community knows about it and they know how to use it to prevent an accidental death from an opioid.
Naloxone reverses overdoses by knocking opioids off brain receptors and blocking them from reattaching. The effects are temporary, so anyone experiencing overdose should get immediate medical attention. Emily Hirio with the Washington State Department of Health says nasal naloxone, also known as Narcan, is effective, safe, and available to anyone over the counter.
Naloxone reverses any type of opioid overdose, whether that's fentanyl or carfentanil or other synthetic opioids. If people have naloxone and they think they are seeing an opioid overdose, they should absolutely administer it.
Hirio adds naloxone is safe for people of all ages, including infants, pregnant people, and older adults. She says rural residents can order the medication through the mail from the Department of Health, and the state also has a map online to help people find free naloxone near them. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
In his State of the Union speech last month, President Donald Trump proposed a new retirement savings option for workers lacking access to a public pension or 401k plan. Financial experts say the proposal could be a game changer for tens of millions of Americans. However, more specifics are needed. Catherine Carley has the details.
Financial experts say President Donald Trump's retirement savings proposal could help the tens of millions of American workers lacking financial security. The plan is similar to those offered to federal workers, with the government providing a match of up to $1,000 a year. Karen Andres with the Aspen Institute's Financial Security Program says new ideas are needed to help those without a public pension or 401k, but many questions remain.
How does it fit in with the existing retirement savings industry? How can we ensure that the workers who need it the most have access to it or are automatically enrolled into it?
She says the plan could build on the 2022 Secure Act, which created a Savers Match program set to launch in 2027 for low to moderate income workers. Trump says he wants to ensure all Americans can benefit from a rising stock market, but experts note it will take the will of Congress to make that a reality. Public sector jobs have historically offered reliable retirement benefits, especially for Black workers and women. But more state governments are shifting away from pensions towards 401k-style plans to reduce financial liability. Experts say that means greater insecurity for individuals and communities that have historically been denied other pathways to wealth. Andres says small businesses are also less likely to offer any sort of retirement plan due to the cost.
This is what we have to fix. Is, in my view, and in our view at the Aspen Institute, is to ensure that everybody in America, no matter who you are, where you work, or how you get paid, has access to a really high quality retirement plan.
Andre says she'd like to see a greater focus on strengthening Social Security. The trust fund that pays Americans retirement's benefits is projected to run out of cash by 2034. President Trump has vowed to always protect the program, but didn't address the pending shortfall in his speech. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, March 16th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson, Nina Mayfair, Josh Salem, and Masato. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Nick Caperso. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Frida Ross, Nadia Ramlagan, Danielle Smith, Roz Brown, and Catherine Carley. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're digging into Portland's Leech Botanical Gardens and the community's effort to save it.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
At the corner of 122nd and Foster in southeast Portland, there's a 16-acre forest sanctuary that almost didn't come to exist. Today it's known as a hidden jewel of the city, the result of a nearly 100-year community intention. Some people don't even know it's here, while others rely on it for peace in the city. But after recovering from its time as a sawmill and a pig farm in the early 1900s, being spared from decades of urban development, and surviving a brush with abandonment in the 80s,